Who is Jesus? It's a question that sparks many answers. But Jesus isn't defined by who we want him to be. He's defined by who he says he is. And in the Bible, Jesus says a lot about who he is. At the Gospel Coalition's 2024 Women's Conference, we'll look at the seven I Am statements in John's Gospel. You'll hear keynote messages from Jen Wilkin, Melissa Kruger, David Platt, and more. Join us June 20th through the 22nd in Indianapolis to feast together on the words of Jesus as we behold the truth and beauty of who he is and then believe in obedience with our whole lives. Register today at tgcw24.org.
I think when it comes to the compassion fatigue, one remedy in some sense is just to accept our limitation. You know, we can only take in so much, we can only do so much, because I mean, sometimes I feel like I'm 5 days behind on whatever happened. And then you feel like, oh, I totally missed it, you know, whatever. But I think to say, am I in the moment doing the good I can in the world I'm in, you know, when I see it, whether it's like at the grocery store and you see a lady who's in a wheelchair or having a hard time getting up and you just stop to help her. You know, I think that's sometimes what we miss, kind of like what you were saying, Jasmine. And to in my real world, am I doing what I can to love my neighbor and be aware of what's going on, you know, around me.
Right.
But also rest in the fact that a better country's coming.
Welcome to the final episode of Let's Talk Season 3. I am Jackie Hill Perry. Jasmine and Melissa and I have enjoyed talking about applying biblical wisdom to everyday life, and we hope you've enjoyed listening in. I believe that you did or will. I don't know. The great thing about a podcast is that the episodes don't go away. They don't disappear. They will never leave you nor forsake you. So if there are any that you might have missed, you can go back and find them at tgc.org/podcast.
Today we're going to answer some questions that have been sent by listeners, and y'all are nosy.
They send in a lot.
Y'all be wanting to know a lot of information.
They think we know everything.
They asked everything except the brand of deodorant we use.
I know. It was a long list.
So Melissa, what's our first question for the day?
Okay. Ooh, this is an interesting one. What's your number one tip for improving communication in marriage?
Improving
nudity.
Oh, what?
That's our next question, Jasmine.
So, I mean, you know, or vulnerability.
Maybe that's your answer for everything.
Seriously, my answer is nudity.
How do you overcome shame?
Nudity.
I don't know. I think first you have to get over the hump of what's keeping you from communicating, whether that's fear, whether that's shame, whether that's pride. You know, all the things, but you just kind of have to get over yourself and be willing to talk about the hard things and the good things.
Yeah.
You know, you just got to talk, actually.
Yeah.
Like, I remember there was a season in our marriage where it was just a rough time, and we were probably married for 6 months. And so, you know, that's when everything hits the fan, usually. And we didn't have enough money for cable. And so our cable was cut off. I might have told this story before, but follow me. And in that time, because we didn't have TV, we were forced to talk. Yeah. But it was crazy because it actually helped our marriage. Not because we were talking about the hard things all the time, but we just became friends again, you know? And so just turning off TVs and things and just talking.
That's good. Mm-hmm. That's good. I think, too, it needs... There's a difference between proactive talk and proactive speech and reactive.
Explain.
And I think in marriage, you can get into reactive, like I'm reacting to the fact that I've been secretly mad at you for the past 6 months because you keep, you know, leaving your socks wherever, you know, and so I am now going to pour out all of that from this past 6 months on you because I didn't proactively tell you earlier on, hey, it's really bothering me that you're leaving your socks there. And so I think that's the type of communication, the reactive kind, that's only, it's not healthy, you know, and I can fall into that very easily. So I try to be more proactive rather than stuffing and stuffing and stuffing and then reacting.
Yeah. Suppressing is totally a thing.
Yeah.
I think also knowing your spouse, getting to know your spouse, finding the understandable part of your spouse. I know not everybody is into the Enneagram, but learning, when my husband and I first started reading my Enneagram, and he was like, I really identify with being an Enneagram 8. Now, whatever you think about that, knowing the fact that he identifies with that description when he reads it, when I go and read it, it's really helpful for me to be like, okay, so that's how you're processing. That's how you're thinking. When you say X, when you say Y, this is what you mean. And so an example of that, the other day I was out. Philip is an Enneagram 8 and he has ADHD.
Okay.
So he's in his office upstairs, above our garage, and I go out there, and I was kind of feeling, sometimes I just feel like lonely during the day, so I go out there and find an excuse to talk to him. I'm just like, hey,
so sweet,
what do you want from the grocery store? I like eggs too. So I was kind of like lingering, and he goes, are you gonna be out here long, because I have to get back to work? And I just looked at him, and like my immediate reaction was like, excuse me? But then I stopped and thought about it, and I was like, he is being really task oriented right now, and he is afraid that if we get off into a conversation, he's going to forget what he was thinking about, what he was doing, what he was. And so I kind of was like going through all that in my mind. And it was so funny because, again, pregnant, so like hormonal, I didn't realize that I was like tearing up because he had hurt my feelings. So over on his side, he was like, oh, and when I said that to her, she felt like I didn't want to be with her. And she felt, so like both of us were like trying to think for the other person. It was just a really good communication moment for us, because I was able to be like, that was kind of hurtful the way that you said that, but I understand why you said it that way. And he was like, thank you for understanding what I needed, but also I should be way different when I'm communicating it to you. So understanding each other and being for each other is
really huge. The more I started to understand how Preston thought and how he literally does not think like me, it made me much more gracious. And gracious even towards myself.
Yeah.
Because it's like, oh, I don't communicate well all the time, and I'm assuming that you should understand me. But no, I just need to be clearer.
Right. And personality tests are huge. I remember the first time, this was a different type of test, but I read Mike's, the grouping of his. I was like, hold on, there's a whole group of people like you? I thought you were the only one, and you were just wrong about some things. And then just to realize, oh, it's just a personality type, and it's so different than mine, and that gave me understanding. I do think that's
well. Speaking about marriage and communication, I have a question that, you know, the naked lover over here would love.
Nudity.
How do you talk about sex in marriage?
It's the same tool set. Like understanding, finding the understandable part of your spouse, and finding the understandable part of what they desire, how their desire works, how they're... So I grew up hearing all the time that men were just like lust-filled monsters who, like, if you showed your clavicle, they were just going to be like, oh my gosh, I must have you. So when I got married and my husband was like a regular person around me, I was like, I not the most desirable person that you've ever seen? I'm confused. Because my whole life, they told me that if I unveiled this clavicle on you, you were going to be putty in my hand. And now the clavicle is out and like, you ain't putty. So what is this? Yeah. So learning that he wasn't just some man, right? But like learning what he needed and what he wanted and what he desired. And for him, vice versa, was really helpful. Because I think so much Christian sex advice just assumes that women are one way and men are another way.
Yes.
And a lot of times in our relationship, in our marriage, it's flipped. And that made me feel like something was wrong with me for a really long time until I realized that, no, actually, you're just two individuals, and you were made for Philip, and Philip was made for you. And this book is not understanding that.
And I think it's also probably important to understand your sex life as a form of communication. And that maybe if something is wrong there, something is wrong in your regular communication to me. Or maybe a better way to say it is, it's a temperature gauge of how well your communication is going. It says something. And so it's good to keep watch on what's happening there, because it's communicating something about your marriage. Mm-hmm. And it's just good to be thinking about it. Like, what is it really cold and distant? Mm-hmm. Well, that probably is because something else is going mm-hmm. on, you know? So I think it's a good gauge to keep watch on.
Yeah. Sex has been something that me and Preston have had to communicate about often. Because I mean, sex it was introduced to me in a really traumatic way because of sexual abuse. And I think even the pornography thing, you know, watching pornography from the age of 7 to 19 really did a doozy on the way I understand sex and sexuality and the body. And so it's something that we always have to process through, because I have these filters by which I see sex that affects us, you know? And so I often have to explain, it isn't me rejecting you, you know, it's rejecting how I feel during a particular act. And so I think it's really been super helpful for him and for me and our marriage as a whole, that we've had to really just work through so many sensitive and intimate things that have grown us intimately, or it's grown our intimacy emotionally, which then affects us sexually. And so
that's good. Actually, that leads into another one of our questions. I kind of feel like is, why don't we talk about women and porn use more in the church? You know, that because it's affecting not just men in the church, it's affecting women in the church. But we typically hear it kind of like what you said, Jasmine, as a male problem. Mm-hmm. And how do you think that is even affecting the shame attached to it and all of that for women?
Yeah, I think it's just that whole separation of like blue sexuality versus pink sexuality. Like, women are emotional and they just want to be held, and they just want to, they're like pressure. They're like crock pots, and men are like microwaves. And if you want to have sex with your wife, you have to come home from work and you have to be, you know, doing stuff for her so that she is ready and willing. And my newlywed self was like, whatever. Hi, let's go. Let's do this. So I felt crazy. And I think that a lot of women who struggle with lust or pornography are often made to feel like they're an anomaly because all of the conversation about sex and temptation is really centered around men being the ones who struggle with temptation and women being the ones who have to like be the stopgap for the temptation and cover the dangerous clavicle
area. Hide your ankle.
And I think important. We have to acknowledge that there are different mediums by which people engage in pornographic material. And so whereas men are highly inclined to deal with visual porn, women are, they statistically are more inclined to romance novels that have pornographic material in it. And so I think that might be why, because we don't look at reading a really sexually explicit book as being pornographic because it's not people on a screen having sex.
Or even where it is people on a screen having sex, like Outlander or Bridgerton or, but as long as there's a plot, then it's fine. I remember like when Bridgerton came out and I was watching it and I was like, guys, I was like, what are we doing right now? I didn't finish Outlander, same reason. And, you know, those are choices that everybody has to make based on their level of maturity and based on their level. Because some people just know how to pick up the button and fast forward. And some people are not affected by the same thing. So that's not like a judgment. But I do think that sometimes we get away with watching certain things and imbibing certain media because there's more to it than just the sexual aspect. And so like, oh, yeah, I like Bridgerton because, you know, the costumes. Are so good.
Yeah, and those costumes keep coming off.
Right.
Exactly. Just because it's a period drama.
Exactly.
It makes you feel like it's a little more refined.
Yeah, it makes you And it's because it's like takes a while to get to that, you know. It takes like you're in like the fourth or fifth episode before you're like, "Oh wow, the bodice is ripped." Okay.
Yes. And that can actually be something that's a little more shocking. Like when you're, you know, if someone's going after strict porn, they kind of do know what they're going after in some sense. So I do think, you know, our world is trying to give it to us.
Is that much more deceptive?
Yes, it's more deceptive. That's exactly right. Now, I think, I don't even think I've understood the difference it's made to have video, like online video access. Like when, so when I was growing up, the only option for kids seeing porn was an old Playboy magazine.
Right.
And, you know, and so it was so different. You know, you couldn't, you had to actually go buy it. I mean, so just my access to it was so much more limited than mm-hmm. what kids have today, where they can stumble across something and they're just curious, mm-hmm. you know, and so they see something and they're like, what's that?
Yep.
You know, and so I do think it's a really tough thing. But I think with women in particular, I've heard that when it's addressed, particularly from the pulpit only to men, mm-hmm. it actually makes them feel more ashamed. You know, that mm-hmm. it's not being discussed as a male and female mm-hmm. problem, that this is something that women are drawn to as well.
Yeah.
And so I think that is important, that it should always be men and women are fighting this. I will say this, though. I do think it has definitely affected how women are sometimes viewed in the church, because if our leaders are watching this, it's going to affect how you view women in your life.
Has to.
And mm-hmm. so I think, and it's obviously, I don't know how it's going to change how women view men in some ways, but I think it makes us more dangerous through no fault of our own, mm-hmm. just because it's out there. Mm-hmm. And so it really is such a difficult struggle for both men and women, you know, in our world today. And I think it's changed a lot of things. I think it also changes our marriages. Mm-hmm. That's what I've heard from a lot of younger women who struggled. And when I was in women's ministry, one of my friends who shared with me some things, it affects marriage mm-hmm. because she didn't feel like she lived up to that standard.
Correct.
And that's a whole, you know, you're now competing in a bedroom with all these scenes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that's going to affect your marriage.
Or it affects women who are attracted to kind of the perverted, dominant men that exist in things like 50 Shades of Grey,
yeah.
who are you know, not passive,
yeah.
who are in control, who are doing those things. And so you kind of then are attracted to men who dominate you mm-hmm. in ways that are not godly, mm-hmm. you know, where you kind of are attracted to those types. Let me stop repeating myself. Yeah. And so I think it definitely, it's just, it does not renew our minds
no.
right.
in the way that God delights. It really does renew our minds in a really dark way, but we thank God for the Spirit.
Yeah,
He's able to recreate.
And I think we can say to anyone struggling, find an older woman in your church and actually talk to them about it. You know, it doesn't have to have shame. If we have struggles in this area, go find someone who can talk to you and pray for you.
Yeah,
I think we'd all say, I think people are more understanding. Hopefully, I say that, you know, I mean
it's hard to speak up, yeah, right? Yeah. But this doesn't change unless we start doing that.
Exactly.
Somebody's got to do it.
Yeah, that's right.
Speaking of homes.
Well, we just went like so deep and now we're going to come back up to the show and talk about some DIY. So ladies, DIY, yes
or no?
Sometimes.
Oh, you're a fool. Yes.
I can't even believe you said sometimes.
No, because that was the season I was in. Okay. And so I decided to stain my steps and paint my wall yes. and, you know, sand and paint my baby's crib because we were in an entire pandemic.
But that's like enough for you to say yes forever. Like that's forever. That's enough activity to say yes forever.
What do you mean?
Like if I had done all three of those things, it wouldn't matter if I never did another DIY thing in my life. I'd be like, I am a DIY goddess.
I will say that, like, I think working and renovating and beautifying my home is just an extension of my like creative mm-hmm. side. And so yes, insofar as it helps me to like express myself creatively and make something beautiful, sure. But like the cats that will like install trim and, you know, like tearing down walls and installing windows by themselves, I'm not that. I'm gonna pay somebody.
Yeah.
I'm gonna find you on Yelp. I'm going to give you this down payment for you to go to work. I'll paint. I'm not tearing down nothing. I'm sorry.
I'm not even going to paint.
Yeah.
My mother-in-law is at home right now. And she was like, hey, while you're out of town, I might go come over to your house and paint the boys' room for you.
It's kind of fun.
Is that okay? And I was like,
and I secretly just yes. kind of I love the smell of paint. Secretly.
Well, she got the no smell vanilla paint.
Oh, it's no fun.
She did. She's like, I'm just worried about you because you're
I like the clean smell. It feels like the house
is
clean.
It feels like fresh. It feels new.
I kind of like when things smell toxic. Gas.
That's another markers.
Today in True Confessions of Let's Talk hosts.
Like the nail salon,
she's
the stuff they put
the
on you.
Glue over there.
Acetone, all the things. No?
No.
Got it. Feeling shame. Let's go back to episode 2.
Don't feel shame. It's okay.
I know. I don't have any DIY.
See,
I wish I did.
We feel shame about that.
I know.
So.
I totally wish shouldn't. I did.
You're just you over are, there. Proverbs 31
in it. We are
all
creating something.
Yes.
That's all DIY is creating.
I do garden. I create a garden.
Okay, there
and
you
I
go.
I love creating a garden. I love.
You just gonna leave me like that?
Yeah, sorry.
That is
wow.
DIY.
Wow. Yeah. She really just left
I do
me.
Love a garden.
You're creating a kid.
I am doing that.
You didn't do it yourself.
I didn't.
But you.
I'm doing it myself right now.
You are. You in the Lord's hand.
I know. Here's another one, especially because we have TGCW 22 that we'll all be at coming up this summer. What women's events have impacted you, if any have impacted you?
Glory, Jackie's event.
Oh, did you go?
No, I haven't been to a single event.
Okay, but it's impacting you.
Yeah.
Okay, tell me about that.
Well, because Jackie is so fly. Like, I don't even know what you'd be talking about, but you'd just be on stage, her wing be flipped, and the outfits.
She had the yellow suit.
A yellow suit.
You guys are really worldly.
We are. Yeah.
No, nothing spiritual.
You be looking real good, and I'd just be like, yeah, I know her. Yeah, that's my friend.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
I'll be the holy one in the group.
Yeah, go ahead.
I did go to one women's event maybe 5 years ago. And I think what made it really unique is that they were walking through themes related to, I think, atonement or something. And one thing I really appreciated is that after every session, the worship songs were centered on the text or the theme that was immediate, like that was touched on during the sermon. Mm-hmm. And so it wasn't vague. It wasn't broad. It wasn't like, you know, she talked about atonement and then we start singing about, you know, I don't know, sanctification.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You understand? And it just was like, oh, this really makes the worship connect to the session. And I don't know, that seems so small, but I guess to me, I was just like, I really like how thoughtful and intentional they were and making sure that what they taught and what they sung were the same.
Did she have on a yellow suit though?
No, because it was about Jesus.
Not the yellow suit, but the yellow suit.
It helps.
She should have wore red. Blood on the doorpost.
I have to say, and I'm not saying this because I now work for TGC, I went to the first women's conference at TGC. I think it was in 2012. And it was the first time I'd been to a women's conference that we weren't talking about womanhood. And for me, that was just so refreshing because I was there with a girlfriend and I remember looking at her and I was like, we're just talking about the Bible. It's so nice because it's not that I'm fine talking about womanhood, but when that was just the topic year after year after year at every women's event, I just kept thinking, you know, I could really hear a talk on kindness and on joy and on patience. I remember at that conference hearing John Piper talking about Isaiah 6, and it was all on the glory of the Lord. And, you know, he made this wonderful contradiction. King Uzziah is dead and the Lord is seated on his throne. But then he talked about the robe filling temple. It was just this great moment. And I was like, this is, you know, I'm getting this image of God's greatness. Mm-hmm. And I actually need that to be whomever I'm called to be. Mm-hmm. Anyway, it was just this, you know, it was just one of those changing moments of, I love having a conference for women that's about God.
Yeah.
And I love getting to be there and getting to study. So
I still return to like two TGC sessions over and over again. One of them is Mike's. He talked about women in the church. And I ended up reading his book, Women in the Church, afterwards. Mm-hmm. And I'll never forget because it's so funny because he's not stoic, but like that's how he comes across. So I walked up to him one time and I was like, I loved your book about women in the church. And he was like, oh, great. You're one of three people that read that. he was like, you understood it. You liked it. Like, wow, that's interesting. Yeah. So Mary Wilson at the time, now Mary Hannah, has a session that's basically about, is God chauvinistic? Is God misogynistic? And I...
That is a great session.
When I was going through the Old Testament again, I returned to that passage. I did it for myself. I did it when I was teaching high school and we were doing ancient history.
Yeah.
I did it, like, I just returned to that one over and over and over again. I'm not much of a conference person.
Yeah.
When I go to a conference, I'm usually a participant.
Yes.
But that particular session.
Yeah.
Literally life changing.
Yeah. Yeah. No, yeah. That was a great, maybe we could put it in the show notes for this episode. Because that one was a great one.
You may not be into women's events, but are you into sports at all?
No.
What about you, Melissa?
Absolutely. I love sports. I was such a tomboy growing up. I can remember in fourth and fifth grade, all the other girls were over on the playground on the swings, and I was on the soccer field. I was the only girl on the soccer field. And I was like, why would I be anywhere else? I love sports. So I played soccer in high school, played tennis in high school. I love playing Ultimate Frisbee.
That's sweet.
You're
so sporty. You're so cool.
I wanted
to be in sports because I just wanted to do something good that other people couldn't do. But when I was in seventh grade, I signed up to run track. And then the teacher, he was the math teacher. Look at that. Mm. He was the math teacher and the track coach. And he said that, like, we're going to start working on running a 5-minute mile. And I said, yeah, no. I'm going to go home. And so it never clicked for me. But I do watch it. I watch basketball and stuff because Preston does. And so I do get into, like, playoffs. I'm not going to keep up with it.
Yeah.
But I know what's happening.
We watched that Michael Jordan movie together, me and Philip, and it was so funny because he was so patient with me because I was just like trying to put everything into context.
We're like, who's Michael Jordan?
Like, I was like, oh yeah, Michael Jordan. He's like, yeah, you know who he plays for? I was like, yeah, the Bulls. He's like, well, what else do you know? I was like, Space Jam.
Oh,
Space Jam.
He came.
I love a good sports documentary.
That documentary was very
good.
Sports
documentaries are so inspiring.
And he like paused it so many times. It was like, explain, like, he was like, that play was amazing. And then he was like, do you want to understand why it was amazing? He pauses and he's like, okay, so here's what happened. And I was like, you're so sweet to me because I don't understand.
Playing a sport, or at least trying, does help you enjoy it more. I remember, I think it was on our honeymoon. Our honeymoon had like a little par-3 golf course. And so I'd never played golf before. And so Mike taught me. And it was after that that I grew to actually love watching golf.
That's a hard
never
sport.
Had before. And then I was like, it's actually hard to hit that little ball.
Oh, yeah.
And it makes you appreciate what Tiger Woods is doing when he goes out and does what he does.
It's like, magnificent. You know, you're like,
oh, that's hard. Yeah. You know, anyway, so playing something can make you appreciate. You actually know that's not easy to get that basketball up like that, and you know,
childbirth is my only extreme sport. That's all I got.
You are the athlete.
That's all I have.
You're winning. You're winning on that
for those moments in my life. I'm an athlete.
Okay, here's another. This is an interesting question. What's the remedy for compassion fatigue? So first, what is compassion fatigue, and then what's the remedy for it?
I struggle with compassion, so y'all will most likely have to teach me.
Is compassion fatigue like where you're just giving so much of yourself, so much empathy and so much like feeling that you just get exhausted? You're like tired out from it. Is that what it is?
Yeah, I think it's this was my interpretation of the question. You know, now we can see into so many more homes and so many more windows with social media. Like, so I actually know in real time that today, you know, what's happening around the world. Mm-hmm. Like, we might know how COVID is raging in a foreign country now in a way that we wouldn't have known even 20, 30 years ago. And so there's so much going on. And then you've got a friend's friend who has cancer.
Right.
And you've then got somebody else's child who was in this accident. And, you know, you're just going down your school. Please pray for this. Please pray for this. And these are people that you sort of know.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But they're not, you know, they're not really close in your life. And so how do we deal with all that's coming at us? Mm-hmm.
I think we have to make sure that we're actually being faithful and compassionate with the people that are in our lives so that it's not performative.
Yeah.
Because it can so easily become performative on social media where it's just like, I'm going to retweet this or I'm going to repost this, or I'm going to, so people know that I know, because if they know that I know, then
yeah,
that somehow will do, you know. So I think being careful that the compassion is being meted out in your day-to-day life.
Mm-hmm. You know, I think when it comes to the compassion fatigue, one remedy in some sense is just to accept our limitation. You know, we can only take in so much. We can only do so much, because I mean, sometimes I feel like I'm 5 days behind on whatever happened. And then you feel like, oh, I totally missed it, you know, whatever. But I think to say, am I in the moment doing the good I can in the world I'm in, you know, when I see it, whether it's like at the grocery store and you see a lady who's in a wheelchair or having a hard time getting up and you just stop to help her. You know, I think that's sometimes what we miss, kind of like what you were saying, Jasmine. And to in my real world, am I doing what I can to love my neighbor and be aware of what's going on, you know, around me.
Right.
But also rest in the fact that a better country's coming, and know that we can do good things here, but we're having to wait for a better final land. But that's, you know,
it's a tension.
It's a tension, because I don't want to say we can't do anything.
Right.
Because we can.
Right. And we should. We do. Exactly. But we live in that tension of the already and the not yet. Exactly. Like, we can make changes and we can bless people and we can spread awareness and we can pray. But also, there's only so much we can do.
That's right.
Because we're finite. Yeah. And because this world is broken until Jesus comes back.
Yep. Yep. That's right. And I think we can be like the prodigal father who was looking out for his prodigal son.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it wasn't like he was in the house. He was looking when he was coming at the thing. So we can be on the lookout for who needs, you know, help today without thinking, I need to go do that on social media. I don't know. That feels like kind of a way we, I think, like to pat ourselves on the back and say, I shared something or whatever.
Yeah.
Versus even if it's just personally quietly praying. Mm-hmm. Okay, I pray about this situation in this country right now, and just doing it really quickly.
Yeah. I think that's even in your own life, because sometimes compassion fatigue can come from being compassionate to people. Like, people in helping professions can get compassionate fatigue.
Ooh. Yeah.
But that, again, you know, going back to our boundaries episode, it's really important to prioritize.
Yeah.
What is God asking us to prioritize, and what do we have to just say? You know what? I can't today.
That's right.
I'm just going to pray for that and trust God to take care of that for today. And then tomorrow, maybe I'll have renewed energy to face.
Yes.
Whatever.
That's right.
Ditto.
So this is a good question for both of you. What are some practical ways to get time away from the kids? Come do a podcast.
take long, long, long showers. If your water bill can handle it. No, seriously, my getaway more times than not is that to really just take a breather. But I've found times where I just have to be, and I know this isn't a circumstance for all mothers, because there are some mothers that are single mothers, where this kind of question is more complicated to answer. But for me, I've often had to tell Preston, hey, just need an hour. Mm-hmm. Like, can you just kind of be here where I can just, and I one time I went upstairs and I laid in my closet with just worship music, because I was like, I was so full of thoughts and ideas and stresses and duties and all the things, and I was like, I'm gonna yell at somebody if I don't decompress in this moment. So just telling someone I need a break, I think that's okay to do.
Yeah. Every night when Philip comes in from work, he knows it's his turn.
Yep.
So, and I was definitely raised on the principle of, like, daddy's been at work all day, so when he comes in, you have to, like, set the stage for him to rest. And, you know, not in my household, because my dad never had a typical 9-to-5, but, like, that's what all of the ladies at our church, you know, that's what, that was a thing. And it's totally different. Like, Philip comes in from work and he told me one time, he's like, but you've been working all day too. So we're just going to work together till bedtime. So he will give me, like, I'll make dinner. He'll take over with the boys while I'm making dinner, and then I'll feed them. And then after dinner is dad time. We're going to hang out with dad, watch a show, do whatever. But mom is usually in the bathtub.
I did for years always lock the bathroom door. and I would just kind of be in there for a while. And it was just because kids will bust in even if the door's not.
Oh, they totally will.
Oh, all the time.
Yes. They'll just like, they just think they can talk to you at any time, even when you're going to the bathroom.
Yeah, we don't come in while I'm like literally on the toilet and be like, how's it going? Yeah. Okay.
And you're like, I'm he's like, trying to get away from everyone right now.
Yeah.
I will say one thing I am a big believer in, and I established this with all my kids at a really young age, is room time.
Oh, yeah.
I think kids need to learn that they can be alone and be okay with that. And so when my kids, they would take the nap. And then when they transitioned, what I did, I made it act like a big reward. You know, so I'm like, well, guess what? If you want to stay up in your bed, you can, and you don't have to go to sleep. And I'm going to put some books here, but you got to stay in your room for this long, or, you know, whatever. I really was a big believer. And then it changed to their whole room. Mm-hmm. And so my kids all did that for years. And so I'd have like an hour and a half every afternoon that I could have just some quiet. It wasn't perfect. Mm-hmm. I mean, when I say stuff like that, you know, kids come out. Yeah. There's always, I mean, you know, whatever.
Hoot has learned how to unlock the baby gate.
Yes.
Like a new era.
Yes. But it was just the pattern. And I have seen it as my kids have aged. Mm-hmm. The benefit is all my kids can entertain themselves. Like, without electronic devices. Yeah, I mean, they all have interests. They all like to read. I mean, they're all comfortable being alone. And I think that's really important. Mm-hmm. And it was really important for me. Mm-hmm. So it was just, that was a way I could get a little time by myself every day.
Yeah.
And that was
I am team room time all day. Yes. And we'll say it. Hey, girls, room time.
Yep.
And they just know, go ahead and march down that hall. Play with your toys.
Yep.
I don't care. You can make a fort.
That's right.
Do whatever you want. Just do it away from me.
Yep.
In Jesus' name. I think one question that we received, which is one worth discussing, is in light of this pandemic, in light of just living in the world in general, loneliness is a thing, you know? And I think we all even go through seasons, married, unmarried, with children, without, having a job, having not a job, having a nightlife, not having, like, where you just have these seasons of loneliness. Mm-hmm. How do we deal with that? How do we cope? How do we help friends that are in lonely places?
I think it's important to understand that everybody gets lonely. Because sometimes I find I'll be talking to people, like I'll put up a question box on Instagram and somebody will ask a question and be like, well, it's really easy for you to talk about X because you're married and I'm single and I'm lonely and I wish that I had your problems instead of my problems because at least you're not lonely. And there's just such a misconception that wifehood and motherhood means an end to loneliness. Mm. But sometimes it can be, it's been for me, because I got married at 24, most of my seasons of loneliness and seasons of intense isolation have been as a mother and have been as a wife. And so I think like extending the conversation doesn't erase the unique struggle of single Christians. Rather, it kind of unites us in this common thing that we all struggle with at different points in time. And there's something so uniquely depressing about married loneliness.
We're it's like, very unique.
They're right there. Mm-hmm. Like, I shouldn't feel so alone. But like, bridging that gap for whatever reason during the season is really difficult. Or motherhood, loneliness in motherhood, where I just remember when Philip and I moved back to Mississippi when Wynn was 6 weeks old, and we lived in Pickens, Mississippi, on a dead-end street that backed up to the woods, and the woods backed up to the highway. Our house had a tin roof, so we had no reception. We had one car. Philip drove it 45 minutes into Jackson every day to go to work, and I lived on the same street as my in-laws. There's no place to go out to eat. There's no stoplights. Mm. There's nothing to do. There's a dollar store. Mm. And I had postpartum depression and I didn't realize it. And so Philip would come home from work every day and he'd say, what did you do? And I'd say, I don't remember. Mm. Like, I could have maybe just sat here and stared at that one spot in the wall over there all day, but I don't know. Mm. I don't know what I did because I was alone and I was lonely and it was so crippling and so difficult. And so my heart goes out to anybody who during the pandemic has experienced that level of, so if the pandemic would have happened that year, that would have been perfect. Oh,
like, I'm already here.
Wow, we're here. We're like in the wilderness. We don't know anybody. This is great, or not great. But for anybody who's experienced that during the pandemic,
my heart does go out to you, and I relate to that feeling of just like loneliness and depressiveness. And I think what I ended up doing with it was, first of all, somebody had to tell me, like, hey, this is depression, and it's not okay that you feel that way, and there are things that we should do about it. And so something that I did is I got a job. I started teaching again. I had taken like 9 months off of teaching. I started teaching again. It was just twice a week, and it was a way for me to get out of the house. I started writing again. That's when I started blogging again. That's when I started writing some stuff for TGC. And then I spoke at a couple conferences. And then I started kind of coming out of myself and being more purposeful about being involved in ministry and in people's lives. So the answer to loneliness wasn't actually my husband or my kids. It was the body of Christ. And so often I think that's the case.
Yeah. Yeah. It's difficult sometimes though, because I don't know how y'all feel. I mean, we're all introverts. And sometimes the hardest thing for me is, because I've gone through some of the probably deepest loneliness in my life in the past 2 years because of a church situation that we went through. But the weird thing was, what I almost didn't need was more people. Like, sometimes you think the antidote to loneliness is people in your life. But it was so hard for me because social things became hard because of what was going on. And I do think there are certain places of loneliness that I felt the tenderness of the Lord saying, I know, and I'm with you. And I, like, there's a verse that says, no one else can know our sorrows and no one else can share our joys or something. Like, I think there are certain pains, and maybe it's the loneliness of singleness or the loneliness of church hurt or the loneliness of a miscarriage or the, you know, certain things that we're going through. I do think there's this place that only the Lord can meet. And maybe by design, so that we run to him. Because, it's difficult. It really is difficult. And that, not to say, I still remember what Jackie, I think you tweeted it a long time ago, what healed my church hurt? The church.
Yeah.
You know, so I think there's this both and. It's, there are going to be certain things only the Lord can hit, but we desperately need the body of Christ to help us in our loneliness. And it's so hard because sometimes that's where the wound happened. You know, and so it's just this strange place. It takes faith to keep plugging in and keep going in and keep entering in. But I think we can all say it's worth it.
And I'm glad that y'all both kind of highlighted that loneliness doesn't necessarily mean lack of community. But really, it's even the people I'm around don't see me. And so I think that's where the leaning into the Lord thing happens, was because it's like, you do see, you do hear, you are knowledgeable about my situation. And oftentimes the way that you remedy it is through other people reminding me that you see me. you ever that's had that good. Person where you lonely and they text you and say, hey, you were on my heart. It's like, oh man, like, that's a reminder that the Lord is placing me on the heart of other people because he sees my circumstance. And now he's opening up a door where I can be seen by another human being by saying why I was most likely on your heart, you know? That's right. So,
yeah, I think that is just one of those good things to remember, is that sometimes when I'm feeling lonely, I realize other people are lonely too. And so I think one thing we can do is exactly what you say. Sometimes I've just asked, Lord, will you bring to mind people I need to pray for? And then by reaching out to them and just texting and saying, hey, I was praying for you today. Sometimes you can feel connected, because I don't know how y'all feel. Like, sometimes I feel way too busy to have another social engagement. Like, that's, I want a deeper connection with people. Anyway, so I think there are ways that we can reach out to others that don't require a lot of time, but can make us feel connected.
That's good.
I don't know. Okay, last of the questions. Kind of, this is it. This is a sad way maybe to end the season. Maybe it's a good way to end the season. What song would you want sung at your funeral?
I love funerals. I'm a bit morbid. I like watching serial killer documentaries, and I've Googled like the autopsies of famous people, and it's just me. But as far as funerals, two songs are what's the word, like, it's not a
Like I'm a resurrect and come for my kids mm-hmm. if they don't make sure this is on the list. great is thy faithfulness. Mm. And it needs to be sang by somebody that's churchy. Mm-hmm. I don't want no great
is thy faithfulness. No acoustic guitar, great is thy faithfulness.
I don't want that. I need somebody churchy. I need an organ. I need somebody screaming and yelling.
Time.
Yeah, I they need to be screaming and yelling.
Yes.
I need at least 16 tongues mm-hmm. to follow. And then the other one is Total Praise by mm-hmm. Richard Smallwood. Because Total Praise is Total Praise. If you've never mm-hmm. heard Total Praise, go to YouTube, type it in, and then you're going to understand Get why saved. I need that.
Mm.
That's it.
Mm. My two are I Won't Complain.
Mm.
Love, I Won't Complain. If by chance I could become friends with Cynthia Erivo before I die,
oh, you want her to sing it.
And then she outlived me, that would be my actual dream.
That would be a very pretty rendition.
After The Color Purple ended, they sang it to, well, it didn't end. I think Heather Headley was leaving her, I'm a Broadway person, but she was leaving her role and Cynthia Erivo sang the first verse of I Won't Complain, which I already love so mm-hmm. much. And then she sang it and I was like, oh my God.
And she sings like an angel.
She sounds like an angel. It was beautiful. So then on the opposite side of that, like I want an angelic, like I Won't Complain. And then I want like a squalling, like throw your shoes in the air. I'm going up yonder.
Going up a yonder.
And I want the bass.
But do you want it while like they're marching your body down
yes.
the aisle? Because that's when I've seen it. It's like, it's that's what they do on
need.
The way out.
I need it to be like, and now she's like, I won't complain. And I need people to be like, oh my gosh, that's so beautiful and angelic. We love her. And then when I'm walking out and they're saying I'm going up yonder, they're like, walking, it ain't even about her. It's about Jesus. Out, like, so let's go.
You're being walked out.
I'm just.
You're being carried.
March me. March me out of there to going up yonder.
I think they played that during in Tony Evans' wife's funeral, Lois Evans, when she was being when her body was being moved out of the sanctuary.
As soon as like at the beginning of that song, as soon as the singer's like, "If anybody asks me," I'm like, "Wait, what?
If anybody,
what are you about to do? I'm ready.
Where I am going."
Y'all have thought about your funerals way more than I have.
No, I have a whole plan in my brain.
I realized when I saw this question, I was like, I'm so excited because I won't be here to plan it.
I'm mad about that, actually. So I'm really bitter.
I know. And I'm like, gosh. So I read this. The first thing that popped into mind was Great is Thy Faithfulness. Mm-hmm. That was the first one for me. But then I really love, and I know it's a like classic funeral hymn, but I really love Be Still My Soul. I just love it. Mm-hmm. I just love the words. I love it. And I kind of like that it's sad and somber because mm-hmm. I think it's okay to be sad, mm-hmm. but it's hopeful too. But it's I had not really thought of this. So I'm glad it will be recorded now. So Mike will
come back to season 3, episode 9.
When
we move on perish. The glory.
Yeah. To close up season 3, if you are at a dinner party and you only know one person or you only know the host or something like that, how do you strike up a conversation with someone who's around you?
I don't.
Basically, we only would talk to each other.
Yeah. I live in Jackson, Mississippi, and it's very old South. And so I went to a dinner party, my first dinner party in Jackson, and the hostess sat us next to people who we didn't know on purpose. Like, we didn't sit next to our spouses.
That's so scary.
And I was just like, what am I supposed to? And it was like a bunch of nerdy white people. Like, it was like, oh, well, in the words of Shakespeare, like it was.
Yeah, mint julep.
Yes, it was. We had a palate cleanser, y'all.
Okay,
that was some sorbet.
It was. I mean, it was delicious food. The conversation was very intellectual and very like, you know, they where you like do a joke in Latin and you're like, oh, and they're like, oh, herb. Like it was. And I don't think I struck up a conversation with anybody. I think I just sat there and was like, I took Latin in sixth grade.
I'm not a conversation striker, mm-hmm. but I feel like I always end up next to people that are. Mm-hmm. And so that might be a part of my expectation is that I don't have to initiate it because there's some extrovert roaming around here that cannot wait mm-hmm. to speak to the quiet person.
Yes.
It's like they're attracted
they
to
are.
The quiet
yes.
person. Like, oh, you're not talking, so I need to talk to you.
Let me help you.
Yes, I just kind of, you know.
Yeah.
I follow their lead.
Yeah, I have kind of a running list of questions in my brain. Because here's what I find. People generally like talking about themselves.
Yes.
So if I just ask a couple of questions, then I just... they're going to talk. So that's what I do. And that's so true. It might be if we're at like a wedding, I might say, how do you know the couple?
Right.
Yeah. Or if I just meet someone, I'll say, so where did you grow up? I try to ask safe questions because there are certain questions you realize that can get really like, complicated.
Who did you vote for in 2020?
I'm not going to ask that question. But even asking, what do you do? Well, then they're like, oh, well, I'm actually in between jobs. Yeah, and then you're like, oh, maybe, you know, I don't know. Or mm-hmm. I mean, I've asked a woman I just met before, so how many kids do you have? And then she's like, well, three here and one in heaven. You know, and you're just like, oh, I'm so, then, you know, you didn't even mean. So I try to ask what I consider. Most people grew up somewhere.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. What are pretty safe questions?
I know a question you can ask. Oh. What song would you want to be played at your funeral?
Oh, that would stress me out. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's a really great one.
These are the things I realize I have not thought
about.
Then
you can Jesus juke if they're not Christians and say, well, you know, we're all going to die,
we're
right?
We're all
going
to die someday.
So do you know where your soul
is
going?
This is why y'all don't talk to people.
Are you?
Do you know where
is
you're going?
Is your funeral going to be an opportunity to share the gospel of Christ with the soon-to-be dying as well? Or is
you
it
hold
going
their wrist
be...
and say, pray with me. Say this prayer along with me.
Yeah, y'all should just remain quiet.
Jesus, I'm a sinner. I acknowledge it.
Come into my heart.
We're thankful that Crossway has been sponsoring this season of Let's Talk. And specifically today, we're going to be chatting a little bit about the book from Paul David Tripp, Do You Believe? 12 Historic Doctrines to Change Your Everyday Life. Jasmine, can you tell us a little bit about it?
Yeah, I'm going to read this quote because I want to get it exactly right. He says, true belief is always lived. So in the book, he kind of talks about these 12 core doctrines, what they are, why they're important, and how they impact our everyday lives. And so it seems like a good kind of primer book. Maybe it'll be a good book to read during devotions.
Yeah.
A good book for a small group, home group.
Yeah.
Good.
And we don't have to be afraid of the word doctrine.
No. And Tripp makes things so simple.
Yeah.
Which is so good.
Because doctrine is really just what we believe about God. Mm-hmm. So it's not scary. But sometimes I think we hear that word and we're like, I'm going to read one page and want to stop.
But he does a really good job of connecting it to everyday life, too, which is really good.
Yeah, that's good.
Jackie, where can we find it?
Well, sadly, I don't have this one in my trunk. But Amazon, you know, the other bookstores, it is available. Or you can go to crossway.org/plus to find out how to get 30% off. Because like I said before, the saints love a good deal. Well, thank you for joining us for this season of Let's Talk. If you find yourself needing something to listen to in our absence, check out the other shows from the Gospel Coalition Podcast Network at tgc.org/podcast. Thanks, y'all.